My question is in relation to a point you made about Democratic intellectuals like Amy Goodman not getting beyond the shopkeeper in their thinking and not getting beyond the confines of bourgeois right. In contrast, the need for communists to continually get beyond the bounds of bourgeois right in their thinking. In studying Views On series, it opens with the understanding that it's necessary and right to want state power as a communist. In thinking about changing people's sentiments, including our own sentiments, it seems that seeing the necessity for wanting state power is one fundamental aspect of getting beyond the bounds of bourgeois right. I wanted to hear more of your thoughts on that and communists continually making ruptures and leaps in their thinking and in understanding and analyzing the world.
Well, I have to say, first of all, poor Amy Goodman. I just use this as an example, but, you know, yeah, I guess it is a useful example. But, you know, she does do a lot of positive things. On the other hand, she does have these limitations, you know, and we have to understand both aspects of that. But the point of singling her out is exactly because she is someone who does do a lot of things of exposing the crimes of the system. And, you know, it's a very, and a point I was making, actually, when I first brought up was that there would be, you know, what would we do with someone like that under the dictatorship of the proletariat? It's a little bit like the Arundhati Roy question. And the answer I gave was fund them, you know, so that they can have the, and then, you know, give, you know, it's like now, you go and you apply for funds, you have things set up under the dictatorship of the proletariat, you know, where institutions, where people will come and apply for grants. Not everybody can get funded all the time, but, you know, you... What will you be guided by? You'll be guided by this, by what I was saying earlier in relation to the question about Arundhati Roy, that this is a valuable role for people to play the same kind of role toward a new socialist government that she's playing now. That she's playing now toward this one. Hopefully she'd be more favorable, even while she still have criticisms, and we should be working and struggling with her, or, you know, using her as a personification of a whole larger group of people to win them over more. But that was the point in which I raised it. And then I said in that context, well, look, you know, Amy Goodman doesn't get in her thinking beyond the realm of bourgeois right. But that doesn't mean there wouldn't be a valuable role for her under the dictatorship of the proletariat. So just to you know, establish, you know, to clear the record here on Amy Goodman, you know, and how we should, you know, should and how I do view the role that she plays and could play under social, you know, in socialist society. But the point is, if you go to those, for example, those three sentences about democracy that appear in the paper periodically, you know, let's see how well I can remember them right now. But, you know, to paraphrase, the essence of the first one is that to talk about, in a world marked by profound class divisions and social inequalities, to talk about democracy without talking about the class content of that democracy and which class it serves is meaningless and worse. Now, if you understand why that's true, then right away you can understand some of the limitations of someone like Amy Goodman, because that's not the way she talks about democracy. She doesn't say, well, you know, we need democracy, but a radically different kind and a radically different context and a radically different set of production and social relations and a whole different kind of economic and political system. She just said, you know, said we need democracy. We need to remove the fetters on democracy. These big corporations and other interests like that interfering with and perverting democracy. She doesn't grasp everything that's concentrated in that first sentence. You know, and then what's said in the next sentence. As long as there are class differences in the world, there can't be any pure democracy or democracy for all. Democracy will always be part of a political system of rule by one class or another. You know, so, you know, this is the essence of what's being gotten there. So then the question is, which class is ruling and what kind of democracy, serving what ends and toward what purposes, and does it serve to reinforce those profound social inequalities and relations of exploitation and oppression? Or does it serve the struggle to eventually eliminate and move beyond those things? That's the way to look at this question of democracy, to situate it within, you know, the context of society divided into classes and founded in production relations on which those classes rest, with a corresponding social relations and superstructure, and what role does the democracy play in relation to that? What kind of democracy is it there for, and what is it serving? Which class interests and which objectives? So, you know, this is the reason that, you know, that I put so much emphasis on this, wrote a whole book on it and keep talking about it all the time, is because for the secular progressive people in particular, or more or less secular people, the equivalent for them of compelling religious belief is bourgeois democracy. You know, it has the same sort of, you know, there was even a movie made called The Contender, I think, with Jeff Bridges and Joan Allen. Jeff Bridges played the president, and she played his vice president, who came under fire from right-wing forces, including because she was an atheist or whatever. And she went to a hearing and said, "My chapel is the chapel of democracy. I worship in the chapel of democracy." Well, that was a very, if you will, class-conscious expression of the viewpoint of certain strata, you know, and a bourgeois democratic viewpoint that holds very powerful sway, particularly among the middle strata, the petty bourgeoisie, and especially the more educated classes and the more, you know, secular people whose religion is not literally religion so much, even if they're nominally religious. And so, if you aren't able to rupture with that, if you aren't able to grasp what's concentrated in those three sentences, to put it that way, if you aren't able to understand the materialism of what's being said there about what, you know, is democracy bound to, you know, what is bound to determine the expression and content of democracy in any given situation? What are the underlying material factors that are going to give expression and shape and content to any kind of democracy? Then you're just going to be completely caught up in the illusions of the reformability of the system, that somehow the best and the highest, you know, the farthest horizon that you can see to, beyond which you cannot get, is to reform the political system, which is still grounded in the underlying system of commodity production and exchange, and in fact, the particular, unique, and essential commodity relation of capitalism, namely the exchange of wages for labor power and the employment of that labor power to produce the wealth that's appropriated privately by the capitalists. That's all part of, that's not an exception to, that's not somehow a deviation from, you know, that's not somehow a perversion of commodity production and exchange under capitalism. That is the essence and the driving dynamic of capitalist production and exchange, and of commodity production and exchange under capitalism. So if you don't get down to that, if you don't see how the whatever democracy there is, whatever political institutions there are, whatever rights there are shaped and determined, defined and delimited and conditioned and confined by that underlying base, then you can never get beyond this continuous illusion of the perfectibility of democracy. At one point in the book, Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That? I think it's in the chapter on the illusions of democracy. It makes a statement, which I think is a very important statement, that the contradiction between what's professed to be the potential of bourgeois democracy and what it actually works out to be in practice, that is, that it's part of a bourgeois dictatorship, that contradiction at one and the same time continually gives rise to the basis for exposure of the nature of that democracy as part of a dictatorship and of the whole system of which it's the political expression, and on the other hand, and at the same time, continually gives rise to illusions about the perfectibility of that democracy. And if you don't grasp the first point, how this is a superstructural expression of underlying dynamics in the material base. And the production and social relations of the material base, then you're always going to be trying to close that gap between the professed ideals of democracy and the reality of what it actually works out to in practice. That it is in fact and always works out in practice to be part of and an expression of and in the service of bourgeois dictatorship. And that, even if people don't understand or agree with that way of formulating it, they experience the reality of it nonetheless. So for, you know, and there are going to be, I think I've made the point many times, it's worth making again, that just as I made about the parachute point, most of the people who make revolution at the time of the seizure of power, who are part of making, in their millions, the leap to the seizure of power and the consolidation of a new state power, most of them are still going to be in one way or another, to one degree or another, still within the confines of bourgeois right in their thinking. They won't have rupture beyond it. It'll be in motion. It'll be contradictory. Some of them will have made the rupture and leap and will be in the vanguard or grouped closely around the vanguard. Others will be, you know, full of contradiction about that very thing and, you know, unevenly understanding it. And many of them will still be, some of them expressly and consciously, and some of them more or less unconsciously, still within the confines, not having gone leapt beyond the narrow horizon of bourgeois right. And it's a whole historical epic of transformation of the all the four alls, of the economic base and the superstructure and all its different expressions and the continual back and forth between those two. And not just in one country, but the interrelation of that in a particular country and the whole world struggle. It's all that that takes up a whole historical epic to where you get to the point that humanity as a whole and human society will have leapt and ruptured out of and beyond the bounds of bourgeois right. And along the way, there's going to be, you know, a lot of people who are going to make critiques of the socialist political system, of the dictatorship of the proletariat, and of democracy as it's practiced under that system, who are raising those critiques from still within the confines of bourgeois democracy, still within, you know, still on the other side. This side of the horizon of bourgeois right. And that goes back to the Arundhati Roy question again. We have to have the correct orientation toward that, even while we're struggling with those people to make that leap and rupture. But that's going to take a whole epic for the overwhelming majority of society and ultimately humanity as a whole to fully jump with both feet and finally and firmly beyond that to get to a whole different place. But the vanguard, the leadership, if you're going to have this, you know, has to do with the solid core. If you're going to have a solid core, that solid core has to be constituted of people who have, in a qualitative sense, made that leap in their world outlook and in their approach to things. It doesn't mean it in some pure absolute sense. You know, communists, like everything else, are contradiction and driven forward by contradiction, including the contradiction between bourgeois and proletarian ideology, but which, you know, Mao said the principal aspect of a contradiction is what defines, you know, again, not in absolute but in relative but real terms, defines the essence of that particular phenomenon or contradiction or process. So for a communist, the principal aspect has to be that you've made that leap beyond bourgeois right. Now, it's not enough to say, by the way, just to be clear, well, in the principal aspect, I've made that leap beyond bourgeois right, so it's okay if I have a secondary aspect. No. There's a difference between recognizing objective reality and raising that to a principle. You know, to the degree that you do recognize that, that's a focus of struggle for you and for you together with others to keep on making that leap more thoroughly. Because, you know, it's not you jump once and you're there and then you can't go back. You're constantly being pulled back, not just by the thinking in your head, but by all the material and social and political and ideological reality that you're still surrounded by and interacting with and which is still overwhelmingly predominant in the society and in the world. But still, the party has to itself and the people who make it up have to, in a qualitative sense, have made that leap and keep on struggling to make that leap again and make it further and to rupture more deeply and more fully. And that's the tension there. It's the tension within the vanguard, among the communists, and between them and the broader masses. Those are the contradictions you have to be dealing with as you go along. You know, and it's like anything else. Whenever you interact with anything else or anyone else or any group of people, you influence them and they influence you. That's why there's a need for constant ideological struggle. That's why there's a need to constantly go back to theory, to go up to the mountain, to use that metaphor again, to wrangle from that level, and then to go back and struggle with others from that perspective, and to do that not just all by yourself. And, you know, sometimes, yes, there is a role for solitude, even among the communists, but not as the principal and essential thing. It's principally and essentially a collective process. So that's what's involved here, and that's the difference between, that's why you have a vanguard. A vanguard is different. It's not superior. It's not made up of people. You know, Stalin made that horrible speech after Lenin died. It's not for everyone. It's not given to everyone to be a communist. I mean, it was, ooh. You know, the speech he gave at a memorial for Lenin. You know, it's not given to everyone. It's people of a special kind. Oh, God, please. But it is true that there are leaps involved. You know, it's not that you are special from, you know, in some sense of being superior to other people. It's just through a combination of, you know, causality and contingency. You happen to come, be confronted with certain things and engage in and make certain leaps. And you're trying to get everybody to do. We're not trying to be a special breed. We're trying to get everybody to do this. But at any given time, there's going to be an objective, you know, objective difference, not of our will and our making, but because of the contradictions in society and the world, there will be an objective difference that we have to live with and transform. And it's very important we have that understanding and that orientation too. It's just a product of a lot of social factors and causality with, you know, in another context, a lot of contingency. You know, if you stepped out in front of this car when you were absent-minded and somebody didn't yell at you and you stopped before you walked in front of the car, you would not have become a communist. You know, or a lot of other things. If this hadn't happened to you, that hadn't happened to you, and then there are some causal things in there too. That's all it is. And then you understand the world has to be, can be, and in that sense should be a whole different way. So you're going, but you also understand that's only going to happen if the masses of people are one to a conscious understanding of this and take it up themselves and then transform the world on that basis through a whole epic of struggle. That's it. There's nothing else. And when you get to that point, you've made a leap and rupture and you have to keep struggling to keep making it, as I said, more fully and more deeply.